Welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast 93 for March 22nd, 2011. I'm Dominic Radi, and with me today are
Ben Snitkoff
and David O'Brien.
We've got three great stories for you this week. Poker bots invade online poker, Amazon and Illinois scuffle over taxes, and photography rights on Facebook. Our first story involves poker bots online. Our story is based off a New York Times article featuring a Brian Taylor, a 36-year-old professional poker player. He was playing online on the website PokerStars, and he noticed that some of his opponents were acting kind of robotically, shall we say. A little bit of research, and he found out they were botting using poker bots that they could buy easily online. He went to PokerStars, told them about what he had found, and the long and short of it is they basically shut down the bots and refunded money to people who had lost money. It's interesting to note that internet gambling itself is legal in the United States thanks to Congress's passing of a law making it illegal a couple of years ago, but online casinos get around that by just operating offshore. The poker bots are all easily accessible online, and obviously the poker websites themselves ban the use of bots in their terms of service agreements, but that doesn't stop people from using the bots. And furthermore, because of the way the poker sites make money, in other words, they take a percentage of every win, basically, if a bot is winning, the poker site itself is winning because they're making money off the bot. So there's a potential conflict of interest because bots making money makes the poker site money. But too many bots and people will leave the poker site. So I guess the first story, or the first question to our panel is, how do we stop poker bots? Terms of service violation, is that enough? Like, we can look at the Blizzard Glider case that came down from the Ninth Circuit late last year, where Blizzard was trying to use copyright to stop botting, and the Ninth Circuit said that, no, you can't do that. This is a contractual issue. It would seem that poker bots are also a contractual issue. What do you guys think?
Well, I thought there was some copyright that they did allow some copyright claims to survive in that case, didn't they? With regard to the generated content, content that was generated on the fly in the game, the content that was saved on the computer was not effectively protected by the
right.
DRM, but the content generated on the fly was. So, I don't think that there's anything that rises to the level of copyrightable generated in these poker games. I mean, it's all images that are saved on your hard drive and then certain hands. You know, there's no creativity in the hands. Not that, you know, you have to have a certain level of creativity, but, you know, I don't think a poker hand is copyrightable where the individual cards are not protected by that.
You have a bigger problem, though. So if you're going to use something like a terms of service agreement to try to stop people from doing this, that's only going to apply to the user who's actually using the website and actually playing poker. You can't make those terms necessarily apply to the developer of the software, and this article mentions, I think, a company that exclusively develops poker bot software, basically, and sells licenses to it. You can't get the terms of that license agreement to automatically apply and sue, so you can go ahead and sue the developer of the software itself.
Yeah, that one particular bot, Shanky Technology, which sells the licenses for a Hold'em poker bot, they said that about 400 of the users had been banned, and one of the poker websites called Full Tilt had seized $50,000 of their money. Which lost them about $70,000 in revenue, apparently. And the bot is available online for $129 a year if anyone wants to go poker bot their way to victory.
So from the software standpoint, and you guys can answer this one, hopefully, how difficult do you think it would be to determine that someone was using a bot if you were the company?
I think it's a lot easier for people to determine that it's using a bot than that a bot is being used than it would be for a computer to detect it. You know, unlike the case... Dominic, make your case for it being easier for a computer to detect.
It depends on how they're setting it up. Like, if you have to download a custom client, like it's not just a Java applet or something, but you're downloading a custom client to play on the poker website, so you have to download a program, then they could look at your running processes list and look for known poker bot processes, or they could look for memory injection reads, or some sort of way of basically saying, all right, we know that this is the memory of what cards we have, and we know that the bot is going to try to read it, so let's see if we can find what we have in memory elsewhere in the system in memory, because that'll be suspicious, right? Because if we have our hand in our memory, and we know that we have that information, then if we see another program somewhere else in the computer with that same information somehow, we can draw a conclusion that there might be a bot running on the system. Also, you can do some sort of rudimentary pattern matching stuff, but that can be hit or miss depending on the sophistication of the bot. The easiest way to detect it is probably going to be seeing if the bot is running on the computer. There's ways around that, proxy setups, mirroring, running bots in virtual machines so that you can't see the process list because the bot is actually outside the virtual machine that the client is running in. But it's basically an arms race, and you can never get 100% detection, but you don't want 100% detection as a goal. You want to get to the point where 99.9% of your people aren't going to bother with using a bot because they know they're going to get banned. And so the 0.1% you can just manually detect.
Interesting. Sounds like these companies need a program like Steam or Punkbuster.
Punkbuster on Steam?
I think it was on Steam at one point. I couldn't remember. I started saying Steam, and then I couldn't remember if those are completely separate entities. But
so what is Punkbuster?
Games. Oh, it's just anti-cheating software. It used to be the case that if you went into certain gaming servers, you would have to, basically they would have something like Punkbuster on there that did, I think, local scans of your RAM and was checking basically for known files associated with cheating or enabling cheats in the game. Client side.
Okay. I mean, going back to the, I guess, the initial prompt here and why we're talking about it, I don't know what else these companies have to do to discourage use of poker bots. I can't help but think that, at least for now, the knowing that your assets could be seized and whatever assets you have tied up in the game could be seized if you use this poker bot is a pretty good deterrent. You know, if what we heard is true that 400 people's accounts are frozen and $50,000 in assets are seized, that's over $1,000 per bot, and that's money that these people, you know, either won fairly or unfairly, and you know that was their money one way or another.
It's somewhat nice to see that the company appears to try to establish some channel of recourse to the people who lost money to the bots, so at least they're giving the money back and it's not like they're keeping it after they lost money to bots, you know. Aside from that, though, why I thought it might be interesting to talk about how you could determine if someone was using a bot or not is that if you ever did bring those people into court for using the bots, you might have some evidentiary problems trying to establish that there was, in fact, a bot being used. Of course, that would depend on the difficulty of detecting the bot in the first place.
Well, you can seize the person's hard drive, that helps. But you might not be able to do that.
And it might get complicated since most of these are overshores operations. Then you get into the international jurisdictional issues as well.
Interestingly, the author of one of the poker bots argues that poker bots are a natural extension of the game of online poker, which I find kind of a facetious argument, but I kind of see where he's going. He basically says that poker players can configure profiles and sort of have the bot try a strategy and see how the strategy does, basically automate their play, maybe run a couple bots in parallel, just test things out, try various strategies, and sort of do research that way. My view is that's all well and good as long as you're not violating the terms of service of the poker service that you're using. If a service wants to allow online bots, they're very welcome to, but I imagine most human players want to play against other humans and not against bots.
Yeah, amusingly, there were also some similar debates going on in the online chess community where money was not at stake. At least these debates were going on when I was a member of the online chess community. You would, there were some services where you would, pay a monthly membership. So you'd pay a monthly membership to the site so you could log in and use the servers and compete against other, ranked players. And, at the same time be ranked yourself. And bots, there was a variety of chess bots. And you could, some of it was transparent where they would mark themselves as bots and you could choose to play against them. But some of them were people pretending to be people, but marking themselves, bots pretending to be people. So you'd end up playing against a bot even when you were not one. You would end up playing against a bot even when you didn't want to, right?
Yeah, I mean, You see this even in correspondence chess. Like, there's very little, there's no way to detect it except for pattern matching. Like, very skilled. Like, if I'm playing correspondence chess with Ben and I secretly use a chess engine to make my move, he has no way of knowing that, unless he's a really skilled chess player who can identify the patterns that common chess engines use. Because if you are a skilled chess player, you can actually tell when you're playing a computer just because of the way they play is not. There's differences in how computers play, and the same is true for poker. Generally, you'll see things like they're just too accurate. They understand stuff almost perfectly in terms of probabilistic calculations. You can get around this a little bit with randomness, but it's actually very hard to make a computer program that acts human, the Turing test and all that.
Isn't that like a fundamental component of being a poker player, though, is that you're dealing with probabilities at some level for when you're drawing cards and stuff, and you're also kind of playing other people's moves?
Yeah, it depends on what kind of poker game you're playing. Some people, and by that I mean both what kind of game, is it hold'em, is it stud, is it draw? And the other part of that is what kind of player you are. Are you somebody who just plays the odds, or are you somebody who plays the odds and plays the people?
And that's part of the beauty of poker, that it's not just a statistical modeling game, but also a psychological modeling game. Computers are very good at the first part, but the second part, it's really hard for a computer to effectively bluff in the sense that there really isn't there. It's just mathematical calculation. And online poker is different than real poker in that, well, not to say that it's not real poker, but you don't have facial expression, you don't have body language, you don't have the way their hands twitch or anything like that. There's a lot less tells to look for.
Unless, of course, you're sitting in IRC and making emoticons.
Right.
Worst poker player ever.
Pretty much, but I mean, the New York Times article concludes saying that we're going to see robots more and more interacting with humans. And that we should just potentially even get used to this. I mean, is that true? I mean, we saw Watson on Jeopardy a couple weeks ago. Deep Blue destroyed Kasparov a couple years ago. Are we going to cede more and more of the quote-unquote human ventures to robots, or are we just going to have to deal with robots? I mean.
I don't think there's any question that we're going to cede more and more to robots. I mean, there was a time when railroad ties were only put in by people, and then, that machine that put in railroad ties came along. It's, a natural part of, evolving technology. For a while, we had rickshaws that were pulled by people, and then we got, chariots pulled by horses, and then cars pulled by mechanical horses. There are always going to be certain legislative and contractual ways that we try to discourage the use of them, but at the same time, there's always going to be people who will find ways to get around it or ignore those demands.
Yeah, I think that there's always going to be people out there who try to figure out how they can automate things, and in some cases where there's a financial gain at stake, there's going to be a lot of people, a lot more people than might be the case in other instances. So this is probably something we'll continue to encounter. I don't know what the best way is right now to block this stuff, especially for these types of companies who are overseas, and technically they're operating under different laws than would be applicable here in the US. Certainly, though, it's going to be a challenge, and it's a mixture of law and technical innovations which will probably be needed to stop these types of things in the future.
Legally, I don't think that there's anything that the poker websites can go against the people selling the bots themselves, right?
As far as I know, I think that's correct. You might make an argument. Of course, we're sort of analyzing this here under US law, and that might not be what applies overseas. I'm pretty sure it wouldn't apply. But if this were something that was going on in the US, you might have to make an argument that was similar to the Blizzard Glider software case that we talked about, where if you have to reverse engineer in some way the code that's making the poker website work in order to get the bot to kind of seamlessly integrate into it, you might have some underlying copyright claims or anti-circumvention claims that you could make, but we don't really know that just on the facts here, and so we're only speculating. Also, that would probably play into a similar breach of contract argument under the terms of service, assuming that would be prohibited under the terms.
Right. It sounds like that's the way that the websites are, currently aiming for. They're doing breach of contract and the remedy for breach of contract appears to be seizing any assets that the accounts have at the site.
Unfortunately, it still looks like it's win-win for the people who use the software. I mean, if you get caught, no big deal. You lose money that you weren't entitled to anyway. Maybe you just lose the time of setting up the computers to automate the play.
And
Really,
ultimately,
who's losing in the end is the other players who are legitimate.
any sort of mass market commercialized bot is going to be detectable and shut down just because of the fact that it's mass market and commercialized. You're probably never going to be able to catch the guy running a bot that he custom wrote by himself, that does things its own idiosyncratic way, just because it's not worth your time to go get that one person. But the people making money off the bots, they're basically trading, their technical skill and selling the bot and then making money off selling it, versus, I mean, eventually the bot will be easily detectable and bannable because of the fact that it's so popular.
Right, and the one thing, the one last thing that I'd like to mention about this is that bots on poker sites are it's not really an emergent problem. It's just become a bigger one recently because they're getting better. Back when I used to play poker and did not violate any federal laws, there was a constant kind of low-level talk about bots and whether or not they were an issue. And I think the like I said, the worry is that now they're getting better, whereas they were not winning tons of money before.
Yeah.
Any last thoughts on this before we move on?
All set
All
here.
set.
And our next story is that Amazon is getting into tax fights with the states in which it has, well, some states in which it does have some form of physical presence and some states in which it does not. So there's a story, I guess, as a bit of introductory matter, a couple of weeks ago that Amazon said that it was going to pull its it has a subsidiary or a corporation with which it contracts. It was going to pull that corporation out of Texas because Texas government had threatened to make Amazon charge or collect sales tax for the state. And recently Amazon got into a similar battle with Illinois. Illinois Governor Pat Quinn signed a law that requires any online retailer that has an affiliate in the state to collect sales tax on any purchases made by Illinois residences and businesses. Amazon quickly responded by cutting ties to pretty much any Illinois-based affiliates, because Amazon, one of Amazon's hooks is that it reduces the cost to people by not collecting sales tax. So I guess I wanted to start the legal conversation by saying that there's a relatively old case now. It was about a 1992 case that said that retailers do not have to collect sales tax unless they have some sort of physical presence in the state that is trying to get them to collect sales tax. It relates to the Due Process Clause of the Constitution and basically protects corporations from being unduly burdened by states with which they have no real contact other than that they make sales to to that state. Do you guys have any initial thoughts as to, the fairness of this in light of how the internet has revolutionized commerce?
What do you mean? That's kind of a broad call.
Yeah, it is. I guess, what are your thoughts? Is it fair that Amazon is getting around this? Is it fair that Amazon should have to collect sales tax in all 50 states, even though Amazon does not have a physical presence in most of them?
Well, Amazon doesn't have to collect sales tax in all 50 states, does
Is
it?
it rather, is it fair that states are trying to individually pass laws that would make Amazon collect sales tax for the states?
I mean, they're certainly welcome to, but Amazon has every right to do what they're doing, shutting down any sort of affiliation with the state to try to get her. I mean, it's a loss for both the states and for Amazon, because I guess the states don't see it as a loss for them, but.
Well, some of the states are. If Amazon had some sort of packaging and distribution facility that was either a subsidiary of Amazon or, a separately owned corporation that contracts with Amazon, and now because of this law, Amazon cuts ties with that organization or shuts down that plant because it doesn't want to collect sales tax, that's a huge loss to the state. Now not only is the state not getting the sales tax that it wanted Amazon to collect, the state's also losing jobs. So it's a
Right.
big loss to both of
But
those.
is Amazon getting rid of it? I don't think it has any distribution centers in Illinois, does it?
It had affiliates of some kind,
Right.
and
Well,
I don't
affiliates are
know.
like you and I can just sign up to be an affiliate.
Oh, you think that's what they were talking
It's
about?
advertising, right? I mean, what
They're
it was
shutting
is.
down affiliates, yeah. It's
Yeah.
like that's sort of the affiliate program, the Amazon Associates program.
These were website referrals that were coming in, I think,
Yeah.
from other sites.
Like, say I live in Illinois, I have a blog, and I link to Amazon.com book and say, buy this wonderful book, and I put in my referral code, I'll get 5% of the cost of the book or whatever paid to me. And now, if I'm in Illinois, they can't do that. I can't sign up as an affiliate or associate because of the law, because Amazon doesn't want to have that business contact with Illinois, because if it did, then it would be liable under these taxes. So it's just cutting ties.
Right, and interestingly, the 1992 case, or now I'm not remembering if it was that case or a similar case, basically said that if you've got door-to-door salesmen who work in that state, that's not enough of a tie because for one, I think in this case the door-to-door salesmen were basically they were paid almost entirely on commission. They weren't really employees in any common sense of the term, and yeah, there also was no physical plant in the state that was trying to get these salesmen to collect sales tax. There was just the individual salespeople going door to door.
Right, you're thinking of Quill Corp v. North Dakota, which is a
Okay.
1992 Supreme Court case that basically said you have to have a physical nexus in the state. What happened there basically is Quill Corp was an office supply retailer. They didn't have a physical presence in North Carolina. They didn't have a sales force, and they didn't have a retail outlet. But they did license. They did have software. They had software that they licensed to some of its customers to check its current inventories and place orders directly. In other words, they basically had prototypical online ordering before the web became popular. North Dakota tried to tax them based on this, and the Supreme Court said, no, you can't do that. All they have is this software that you've given to these customers so that they can order online, to put this in more modern terms, basically.
And right, there have been similar cases that involve door-to-door salesmen, and those were also, similar holding that there has to be some sort of physical plant.
Definitely. But basically what Illinois did here, I don't think we actually said it, they passed a law that said that online-based affiliates is a physical tie for the purposes of Illinois.
Right, and the question, since this is a question of federal constitutional law, there's almost definitely going to be some sort of legal challenge that Amazon brings to this law, as they have brought in at least New York, if not New York and other states. So I guess that leads me to the next question, which is it time for due process, the jurisprudence to change? Is it time for the Supreme Court to look at this and say, well, if you're doing X amount of sales to a state, that's a sufficient nexus to for the state to require you to collect sales tax, or if you have these affiliates. Do we think that's a sufficient tie for due process purposes?
David?
Maybe, potentially. We're sort of in a different situation than when we were back in 1992 now, especially considering we're at the tail end of this crisis and there's additional budget crises all around the country in particular states. And I think those states are hurting a lot because they don't have the same tax revenues that they had in previous years. And if you put all that stuff together, and it really is a bunch of different factors that are affecting states to make these decisions to have these statutes, you could see why a state might be interested in having a large online retailer like Amazon pay sales tax when Amazon offers very low cost items for sale, which they'll ship to you sometimes with very low shipping fees. It's putting the local mom and pop stores, the local retailers out of business. And in some cases, even the large retail space companies like the Circuit Cities and so on and so forth. So be interesting to see how the court actually deals with this. For the legal questions, this is a bit outside of my area. I've never really been a good interstate commerce clause person, or certainly not a good interstate tax person. But I think that there are probably some interesting questions here, and I wonder, and I would ask you guys how, then, if it's just the affiliates in this case, which are the nexus connection to Illinois, assuming that the Amazon kept up those affiliate ties, what then is tax? Is it just the share that would go to the affiliates, or then can all sales transactions in the state be taxed?
No, all sales transactions in the state would be taxed. The share that's already going to the affiliates is being taxed by any state income tax already, right?
Right.
Yeah, I think so, right?
So it would
Well,
be
assuming
basic.
it's reported.
assuming it's reported, which it does because Amazon will automatically report it over a certain amount. I think over $100 it automatically gets reported. But basically, this makes it as a physical nexus so that every transaction Amazon does. So let's say that there's no affiliate involved, but someone's in Illinois. Now they have to pay sales tax on all Amazon.com purchases, affiliate or not. So basically what the law did is it said, if you have an affiliate in Illinois, then that means that you have a physical nexus in Illinois, which means we are going to collect sales tax from you.
I see. And so that burden doesn't fall on the customers, though, who are buying items off of Amazon. It falls on Amazon's shoulders, at least in Illinois.
Is that right?
Well, Amazon would have to do the would have to tack on the sales tax to the Amazon would have to tack on the sales tax to the total,
yeah.
Collect the sales tax, and then remit that sales tax to the state.
Exactly.
Yeah, these issues are definitely complicated, and even after reading the New York Times article on this, I still wasn't entirely sure about how the statute was actually functioning, but. Yeah, do you guys think that, you know, is this the time to revisit this issue in the Supreme Court?
I think it is the time to revisit it at least one way, which is we're seeing, and I like the fact that we're seeing this, but we're seeing a contraction of jurisdiction under subject matter jurisdiction. No. What's the jurisdiction I'm looking for? We're seeing a contraction on where federal courts, what a minimum amount of contact with the jurisdiction is in federal courts for, you know, bringing a case there. So
personal jurisdiction?
Yeah, thank you. We're seeing a contraction in personal jurisdiction with regard to online companies. So it used to be that you could, if both companies had a presence online, either one of those companies who wanted to sue the other could basically sue in any court in the United States and make up some reason that the court would, you know, buy in to say, okay, yeah, we've got personal jurisdiction over you because you have, you know, a certain number of sales or, you've got, you know, customers or, you know, something here in, you know, the Western District of Wisconsin. So we're going to, you know, exert personal jurisdiction over you. And I've been seeing, and I wish I could cite them right now, but I can't, some cases where courts have been taking a new look at this and saying, you know what, you know, random person who lives in Washington, D.C., we're not going to let you be dragged into court here in California just because, you know, this company has one office in California. It's not enough that, you know, the effects of what you did could have been felt in this one this one office building. We're going to have to do this in some place that's a little more tied to what's actually going on in this case.
So this sounds like you're arguing that there shouldn't be these types of laws that force large e-commerce retailers to pay taxes in whatever state has an applicable statute.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, I don't have a big pro-corporation slant for me, but my worry is if any tie whatsoever is enough of a nexus for reasons of collecting sales tax, that will be then plugged back into personal jurisdiction because they both arise from the due process clause of the Constitution.
And what would be the consequences of being plugged back into personal jurisdiction? Like, what are you worried about?
My worry is that we're going to have little people being dragged into courts all over the United States where there's no real tie to the case because it's a favorable court or because it's an inconvenient court. And either way, it is bad for the defendant who's the little guy.
Makes sense.
It's an interesting take on it. I would not have analogized those two areas in my head, but thank you for sharing that. I think it's actually a useful way to think about things, too, because, you know, we do see a lot of terms of use agreements on the Internet where you have form selection clauses and choice of law clauses, which say, oh, by visiting our site and using our services, you hereby subject yourself to the jurisdiction of California in such and such court.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how these sales taxes all resolve, because Amazon has a bunch of states like this.
Fair enough. So do you guys have any further questions or further insights that you'd like to share?
I'm all set.
All set here.
Okay, then I'll take us away to our third and last story. This story is about Thomas Hawk, who is a photographer. He posted a story this week on his website that one of his photographs, which happened to be an image of Veronica Belmont holding what appeared to be an iPhone, was being used on Facebook in an advertisement for a company called Wireless Emporium without his authorization. It's a little confusing, just based on his post, where exactly Wireless Emporium got this image. Thomas does maintain his website, which is thomashawk.com. I don't know that I saw that many pictures posted on there, but he definitely has a very active Flickr account. He noted in the post that neither him or Veronica, who apparently he has some kind of relationship with, neither of them posted this photograph to Facebook. So he was thinking that the only way that Wireless Emporium could have got it would have been by stealing it. Now, he didn't say where that it might have been stolen from. I went ahead and checked out Flickr and on his account or his homepage on Flickr, searched for Veronica Belmont and was able to find the original image, which was uploaded in 2007 at an event in San Francisco. I think it was the Revision 3 launch. And that's Veronica Belmont's affiliation. She's kind of a known entity, I guess you could say, on the internet, does a lot of tech podcasts, video casts on Revision 3, writes articles, frequent guest on This Week in Tech, so on and so forth. So the interesting thing here is Veronica was also the person who tipped Thomas off that the image was being used on Facebook. And I guess there was some chatter back and forth between Thomas and the company, Wireless Emporium, and they said they didn't know how the image was being used and if they hire a bunch of search engine optimization or SEO companies, and that might have been a likely source of it. But getting back to the whole confusion on where they might have got the image, that's an important thing to note, because depending on where they got the original image, whether it was Flickr, Facebook, or somewhere else, that might tell you what license would apply to the work and when they copied it, and what the rights might be that are associated with using that work in different scenarios. Like, would it give you the rights as the company then to take an image and then use it to try to promote your product? Would depend on the license, of course. So the way that I see this, there are three potential lawsuits you could have out of this, or three underlying claims to a lawsuit. You have potentially copyright infringement, breach of contract, and misappropriation of commercial likeness for using Veronica's image in an advertisement. It's also worth noting that the license that applied to the image I found on Flickr is a BY NC 2.0 license, which gives you the right to share, make copies, distribute, transmit the work, to remix the work, which means you can adapt it and make a derivative work based on it, so long as you're giving attribution back to the original author and doing it for non-commercial purposes, which also sort of factors into our analysis. So what do you guys think about what this company Wireless Emporium did here? And is Facebook a potential person of interest for a lawsuit should one ever be filed?
Well, first I want to quickly chime in with a question. Like you said that depending where they got the image, why would it depend where they got the image? The license would be the same, wouldn't it?
Well, maybe. It would depend. So let me give you a scenario here. That, as far as I could tell, that image was uploaded in 2007. I didn't catch the month, but let's say it was
July.
March 2007. Okay, July 2007. So if it was uploaded in July 2007, if Thomas had distributed that work, and let's just say that he uploaded it after he took it, some period of time, a couple of months maybe, if immediately after he took it, if he distributed that a copy of the work to somebody else under different licensing terms than had applied on Flickr.
I see what you're saying.
See, you might not be subject to the same licensing terms if that's the way that Wireless Emporium got a hold of the original.
Right. If the Flickr distribution is the only source, though.
Yeah, and I apologize. It was taken in July 07. It was uploaded in March 09.
Oh, wow. That's quite a long time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, actually, I didn't even know that you did have a lag time, so that's kind of important.
Yeah, it's very...
So, you have a factual discrepancy there of, you know, what distribution might have occurred immediately after the guy took the photo, and, you know, who else was it distributed to, under what terms did he assign the copyright away? Of course, you know, this post says nothing to this, really. I mean, for our purposes here, we could probably assume that this is the only way you could get it, and that there weren't any other licenses or any rights given away to other people. He didn't assign the copyright to somebody else.
Yeah. Assuming that the Flickr distribution is the only distribution point, they're clearly violating the license, though.
Right.
Yes, because this is very clearly a commercial work if it's used in advertisement.
Usually that's the case, yeah.
So would Facebook, though, be a potential party of interest to a lawsuit?
For what, though?
And well, they're the ones, I'm sorry, and maybe I didn't say this up front. The advertisement which used the image was on Facebook, and it was basically a sponsored ad, and it said Wireless Emporium, Veronica likes technology, something, something, so should you, maybe. And so there was the image, and this is a picture of Veronica, and she's holding an iPhone, sort of pointing at it, and then it has that caption, and it has Wireless Emporium, so it's sort of a sponsored ad. I assume, and Thomas assumed too in his post, that Wireless Emporium had, or a company on Wireless Emporium's behalf had purchased the space and the hosting and paid for the advertisement to appear on Facebook somehow.
Ben, go ahead.
I don't know what I was going to say. I got distracted.
So I'll start over by just rephrasing the question here. I mean, what rights do you have as a photographer in a case like this? Because that was basically Thomas's question. He didn't know what to do. He said he didn't know what types of recourse you might have against either Facebook or Wireless Emporium.
Right. I guess so. Well, my initial question is, to what extent is Facebook protected by the DMCA? If they're selling the ad, do they get some sort of liability that would not ordinarily attach for just a photo that was uploaded to their site? And I ask this because I really don't know the answer.
I would assume they have a checkbox that says that please check here to confirm that you have rights for everything that you're uploading, like they do for normal uploads, and I wouldn't see why they wouldn't put that for ads.
But confirming that, you know, unless the checkbox says by checking this box you indemnify Facebook for...
I'm pretty sure it would.
I agree with you, but the one that they have, so they're for user uploaded photos, they have the I agree that I'm, you know, I own this. But Facebook is still protected by the Digital Millennium Copyright
Act. I see what
Act.
You're saying.
So they don't need the indemnity from the individual people who upload them. My question is, do they need indemnification? And for the listeners who don't know what that means, that basically says that if Facebook gets sued because you posted this, Facebook will basically, you know, take whatever company posted this ad and say, no, well, you can sue us, but they're going to pay for everything. So we're just going to step back out of the picture if you don't mind.
Yeah.
And yeah, like I said, I'm trying to think about this, and the DMCA does not apply to... Oh, am I confusing this with the CDA?
Possibly,
because
yeah.
The CDA... So CDA doesn't protect against intellectual property. So the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, wouldn't protect the person if it was a trademark violation. Question, I guess, then, is the right of publicity enough of an intellectual property right, because it's so similar to trademark, that it would also not fall under CDA protection.
Wow, you just took us all over the place there. First of all, I think, getting back to the copyright claim first, you could potentially make an argument that in republishing or publishing the advertisement with the image in it, there's a copyright claim there that underlies that. And as you guys correctly noted, I think that there might be some indemnification issues and that liability ultimately doesn't or might not necessarily fall on Facebook's shoulders for this, but they're still responsible for that initial posting. And to the extent that you could call an advertisement user-generated content, I think that would depend a lot on how the terms are structured between the advertiser or the company who's purchasing the advertising space on Facebook and Facebook and whatever terms are in between that sort of delineate that relationship. I'm willing to bet, though, that a DMCA takedown notice, if properly, you know, sent to Facebook, would still probably be acted upon, just because they would be so concerned about hosting works that they don't have rights to, or the people who said that they have rights to don't have rights to. But it's a little unclear how that would actually apply. I mean, as I guess what I'm saying is Facebook would probably take the risk-averse approach and just take down the advertisement altogether and then sort of sort out the liability issues on the back end once the ad was down and there was no more image attached to it. For the misappropriation of commercial likeness, well, the CDA 230 or the Communications Decency Act, that would treat Facebook not as the publisher, I think, for the misappropriation of likeness claim, there is that statute has a exclusionary provision in it, which says that, of course, this doesn't apply to any claims related to intellectual property. The misappropriation claim is actually one that Veronica would have to assert, I think, in court, since she's the one whose rights are being violated. It's not Thomas's rights. So you potentially have two plaintiffs in a case then who both have claims against Wireless Emporium for doing both of those things. And on top of that, you have the breach of contract claim, which is really what underlies all of this. So if you look back at the license itself, the license says it's okay to retransmit and make copies of the work and distribute it to other people, but you have to give attribution and you can't use it for commercial purposes. So assuming that there was some pecuniary exchange between Wireless Emporium and Facebook, you are violating the non-commercial portion of it. And when in the little screen capture that I saw, there was no indication that Thomas Hawk was the original photographer who captured the image. So any other thoughts on this, or just general bits of advice that you would impart on Thomas?
I guess that's sort of the question that we haven't really answered. Like, so what should he do? Not offering legal advice, but just speculating.
Yeah, I mean, he could send a DMCA. I mean, and something that he put out in his post was, you know, yes, he can ask for it to be taken down, but he doesn't just want it to be taken down. He wants to know who is responsible. And while he talked with Wireless Emporium, Wireless Emporium wasn't telling him which company uploaded that ad to Facebook, and he was having a difficult time getting Facebook to tell him who uploaded that photo. So, you know, short of filing a suit and subpoenaing that information, you know, there at least isn't a lot that I can think of for him to do.
Right. So after the little Twitter exchange, Wireless Emporium did reach out, or at least a representative from the company did, and they said after doing some research, we concluded that the SEO firm that they had hired tried to leverage the popularity of Veronica in the tech community to grow our brand awareness without her permission and without consulting us before moving forward with the ad. Unfortunately, we have no concrete evidence that this firm indeed was the one responsible for the rogue Facebook ad. Nonetheless, within 4 days of finding out about the ad, we terminated all business relationships with the SEO firm based on our internal investigation. So at least the company did something to sort of remedy the situation. They, I guess they tried to get the ad taken down, and they also terminated all their business relationships with the SEO firm. But for Thomas, though, I mean, I guess he still has some remedies at law. It's important to note that just because somebody reaches out from a company and says, well, you know, I'm sorry that this happened. We have, you know, done all these things to make sure that this won't continue to happen in the future. You still have all the infringing activity, if you want to call it that, or allegedly infringing activity that happened in the past up to that point. So it's still okay to sue on the basis of that. But he noted in, I think, on the comment section of his blog post that he didn't think that it was worth pursuing just because it's so costly to obtain a lawyer. In case, I mean, we're not really in the business here of giving legal advice on the show. This is just all information. But the first thing you should do is, I think, in this situation, is consult an attorney and let them know exactly what happened. And they'll have all sorts of questions for you. And sometimes you can do that without paying any money up front. You'll do a consultation of some sort, and they'll sort of evaluate and explain your rights to you. And then, you know, there's ways to go about doing this without necessarily having to pay large sums of money. So do you guys have any other thoughts or any other tidbits?
Another idea is you can look for local law schools that might be doing intellectual property clinics, and you can have law students help you out on your case.
Yes, that is also a good thing to look into. The EFF takes on suits like this all the time. I think Thomas is based on the West Coast. I didn't actually see a location, but based on the number of San Francisco pictures he has, it looks like it might be the case. Quite a few other firms in San Francisco which take on that kind of work. There's pro bono activity at the major law firms. There is also the Online Media Legal Protection Network, or OLMN. It was actually a project out of the Citizen Media Law Project, which I used to do some work with a few years ago. They match up bloggers basically with law firms and pro bono work, and try to make sure that people either get pro bono, which means sort of either low cost or no cost legal services, even on civil claims like these.
Yeah, I mean, it probably isn't cost effective to hire a big firm attorney for this just because it's one photo. And I mean, it's more a question of what can I do? I'm surprised Facebook doesn't want to say, like, and I'm surprised you didn't get the name of the company from Wireless Emporium in terms of which SEO optimization company they used, just so that he can try to talk to them. I mean, it's really frustrating from his position because he's basically powerless. Someone's made money off his photo, and the cost that he's going to have to spend to try to recoup his loss, so to speak, is going to be greater than what he would get back.
Yeah, especially if he hasn't registered a copyright in it.
Yeah. Why is that important, Ben?
If you register the copyright before the infringement happens, you're entitled to statutory damages. If you don't, you're just entitled to whatever the actual damages are. And as we've discussed many times in the past, statutory damages can be ridiculous, and actual damages tend not to be.
Yeah, I doubt he registered the copyright, so.
Yeah, and just to note, the website for the Online Media Legal Network is omln.org. So, any final thoughts, guys?
All set.
All set.
Okay, well, let's close this week out then. Thanks for listening to the podcast. I'm David O'Brien.
I'm Dominic Rabier.
And I'm Ben Snitkoff.
As usual, please visit our website at technicallylegal.org. Follow us on Twitter at @techlegal, or send us comments to podcast@technicallylegal.org and any story suggestions you might have. We'll catch you next week, folks. Take care.